HPPodcraft.com.
Directors, Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, Massachusetts. Gentlemen, today I have just received aboard the SS Madrigal your most kind cable, praising my work and asking, humbly as one might ask it of a true genius, if I would do a statue of myself to be placed among the great in your illustrious museum. Ah, gentlemen, that cablegram was to me the last turn of the screw. I despise myself for what I have done in the name of art. Greed for money and acclaim, weariness with poverty and the contempt of my inferiors, hatred for a world that refused to see any merit in my work. These things have driven me to commit a series of strange and terrible crimes.
Ha! It wasn't the first or the second, but the final turn of the screw that pushed our narrator over the edge.
You know, it's always the final thing that does it in the end.
Isn't that by definition what it is?
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is now that I've said it.
This story is called The Blackstone Statue by Mary Elizabeth Councilman.
A new author to cover here on Strange Studies and Strange Stories. I really loved this one. And when I say I mean me, Chad Pfeiffer.
Hello, Mr. Pfeiffer.
Hello.
I am Chris Lackey, and we are here at hppodcraft.com.
That reader we heard at the top was our old friend Mike Hughes.
Yeah.
Hasn't been on for a while, but he's a man, I think I mentioned then, who has superhero levels of hair strength. Mm. Takes a special barber to cut his hair. They cut their hands on that strong, strong hair.
It's too powerful.
Maybe I didn't mention he's also a former winner on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. That's true.
Right.
And a great creative mind, I think. Speaking of great creative minds, let's hear about this author.
Mary Elizabeth Councilman was born in 1911 in Birmingham, Alabama. She wrote as a child and sold her first poem, which was only 6 years old.
Also called The Blackstone Statue. She was a really weird kid.
She went to college at the University of Alabama and Alabama College. Her first published short story was in the 1931 issue of Myself with a story called The Devil Himself. But her work appeared in Weird Tales, Collier's, the Saturday Evening Post, and lots of other stuff. Her story, The Three Marked Pennies, was published in Weird Tales in 1934 and is one of their top three most popular stories. Mm. So, man, we got to dig that one up.
Oh, we're definitely covering that because I love this author now. And I'm also terrified of pocket change and terrified of people named Mark. Just it's all filthy, both of those things.
Mary was also a reporter for the Birmingham News.
Anything somebody named Mary Elizabeth Councilman writes, I'm probably just going to take as fact in a newspaper. So I could see that being a successful vocation for her. That type of writing background really is on display here, though, because this is a well-written, just the facts kind of pulp story. Mm. Or you had described it as pulpy when you were telling me to read it. It is delightfully that, but I think it's pulpy in its high adventure subject matter. Weird alien tech, a jungle, an undercover lost aviator. But it's not ham-fisted at all in the writing style.
No.
When you read it, you fall right into the page. I would actually say this is one of the best stories we've ever read, personally.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. I mean, if somebody were to ask what sort of thing we cover, I would confidently hand them this story and be excited to get a new listener because it's got everything on display that we get to in some way or another. It's concisely written. It's just a really kind of perfect short story in terms of the ironic ending and the construction of it and the conciseness of it. It's a weird sort of thing to say that because I don't know if my enthusiasm will equal what it was on A Shadow Over Innsmouth or something like that.
Right.
But I really do feel that way. So it's a great example of a weird tale, a weird science fiction adventure pulp tale.
Yeah, I think it's a great story. I'd have to really reflect to say it's one of the best ones we've covered, but it's definitely a good one. Councilman, some of her stories saw the small screen and were adapted for television by the General Electric Theater. This is what she said about her own writing. The Halloween scariness of the bumbling but kindly Wizard of Oz has always appealed to me more than the gruesome morbid fiction of H.P. Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith, and those later authors who were influenced by their doom philosophies. My eerie shades bubble with an irrepressible sense of humor, ready to laugh with never at those earthbound mortals whose fears they once shared. Hmm. And this story doesn't seem so fun. It's actually pretty gruesome.
You got that right. But I didn't feel any like Wizard of Oz
no
bubbliness in this story at all. I had a conversation just like that with Lyle Erickson the other day, because we're working on this new Pitch Black Manor album. We're actually going to premiere a track next month, so that's coming up soon.
What's that album called?
The album is called Night Creeps, and it's going to be, I'll talk about it on the July show coming up next week. Nice. But I was pitching some drafts back and forth with them, and I did a new draft of the song, adding some instruments to it, and I wrote the guys, you know, I just thought the song was missing a sense of fun, and it has to be fun, so I wanted to bring some of that in there. And Lyle just responded, this song's about a serial killer. I go, well, okay, yeah, you know, it's a dark song, but yet it needs to be presented in a fun way, and I think you can have both. So I do think there's a sense of fun to this story, gruesome though it is, in that it's a fun read.
It definitely is a fun read. It was first published in 1937 in the December issue of Weird Tales. Other stories in that issue were H.P. Lovecraft's Polaris and Robert Bloch's Fane of the Black Pharaoh.
Wow, Merry Christmas on that one. That's a pretty good issue.
Arkham House did a collection of her stories in 1964 called Half in Shadow.
There is no way Half in Shadow is not the name of at least 300 high school literary magazines. I thought immediately, you know. What do you think the illustration is on the cover of that magazine?
It's got to be some creepy dude, half in shadow.
Yeah, I asked because I know you would have been the one that would have had to do it.
I would. That's exactly what I do. Some creepy old guy, maybe his fingers templed, you know, his hands in front of him, and then half of him in shadow, literally half, because I would be in high school, so I'd have to do a literal representation of that. So
until the girl who wrote a poem in there goes, I was kind of thinking it would be like hair falling over an eye. You look up and that's what she looks like. And you're like, that sounds great. Let's do that.
So let's get into the story.
Yeah.
Our narrator is an artist who has done something horrible.
I just have to say, and maybe if we have time at the end, I'll talk about it a little, but we're recording this a week later than intended because I was attacked by my own skeleton last week.
Yes.
And I've been in pretty persistent pain. So coming back to the show, we had to take a week off, and coming back to read, I thought, man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get into a story. I just don't feel very well. Let's see. Scanning the top, my eyes fall on this line. I despise myself for what I have done in the name of art. And I thought, okay, I'm going to be fine. This will effectively distract me, I already know.
He's on the ship, the SS Madrigal, and he's sending this story as a letter to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. He says he's a fraud and he's going to come clean.
Right, because they've offered him this high honor of placing a statue of him, the artist, in the museum, and commissioning him to do that self-portrait, which is that something that sculptors typically do?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm not really too hip on the sculpting scene, so maybe it is something
right.
They do. You know, I'm really into the pottery scene. That's where my jam is. But the sculpture stuff, it's a mystery to me.
Yeah, your pottery core.
His story starts way back when he was not a successful artist, but a poor and starving one. He was living in a shabby boarding house and trying to be a great sculptor using a chisel and stone.
The lens opens on such a great scene as described. Let me go back to that miserable, sleet-lashed afternoon as I came into the hall of Mrs. Bates' rooming house, a crawling, filthy hovel for the poverty-stricken like myself who were too proud to go on relief.
Relief it was like welfare, basically, for people that were
government
poor.
Relief, yeah. And yeah. But I thought that this sentence was so excellent because it engages the senses with this scene, the sleet and the squalidness of it. But there's also a little internal conflict right there. In fact, it's a tiny microcosm of the whole story. This too proud to go on relief bit reveals an opinion that in turn reveals character. You know, this person has set himself apart from the rest. That notion that for you the relief is fine, but I'm too proud. I'm of the special class that accomplishes things to get remuneration when they're in bad times. That, you know, I suffered because my merits will be so valuable that's how I'm going to make my way. And, you know, it's a perfect characterization given what he's going to do, because of course it takes humility and connectivity to be truly great at something in the arts. I'd say especially sculpture. And in a broader sense, we also have the notion that we're always partially at fault for our circumstances, I think is an internal conflict that's happening with everybody all the time.
Yeah.
So the thing that sets this apart from a different retelling of the same story is that rather than have a few stock characters execute this plot, the whole thing comes out of the villain's internal conflict right away. A petty criminal who, at the end of the day, who hates himself. Mm. And we've seen this time and time again when the weird is presented in the more omniscient stock way, it's light entertainment, but when it's presented through that internal human heart and conflict with itself, as in Poe or as in Lovecraft's Rats in the Walls, that's when these stories really get better. So that's just a good That's such a good start in a tiny detail.
As the sculptor steps into the scene from the past, his landlady is yelling at a man in the hallway. He needs to come up with a rent, and this man explains that he'll pay her double in a week because he's close to making this big deal of some kind. This guy is lean, and he has got a beard, and he looks really shabby, but he's familiar to the narrator.
I had a really strong feeling that this character would be played by William Powell, who would have been in My Man Godfrey right around this time. Oh. So maybe it was on the writer's mind, but yeah. He just has that... you see him and you go, that's a movie star. I don't know who he, even if you didn't know him, you go, that's a movie star, but he also always looks a little shabby.
Yeah.
Like a movie star undercover, which is what I imagine that this is.
So this lady says, no pay, no stay. And the narrator pulls out the last $2 that he has and gives it to her. And she smirks and walks away.
He paid for the stranger, and it's attached. The way that it's presented here is cool because it's attached to this notion that he recognizes him from somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a... I gotta help this guy. But let's not forget, like you said, he overheard on stepping in, I'll pay you double at the end of that time because mm-hmm. I got this deal in mind. So there's a little bit of spacing there so that by virtue of the way the author ordered these things, it seems like he's giving him the shirt off his back almost by giving him his last $2. Mm-hmm. But is he? Or is he, you know, paying into a scheme that he hasn't mm-hmm. fully formed yet, right? Yeah. And that helps set up what happens later.
So the man thanks him and he explains that he's going to be rolling in dough next week and he will pay him back 1,000-fold. And then it clicks. The narrator recognizes him. He's Paul Kennicott, a famous aviator whose plane went down a few months ago in the Brazilian wilds. But why is he here in the slums? Why is he hiding? What the heck is going on?
What a cool hook.
Yeah.
He does what I would do, which is just hang out and try to see what's up with this guy. Mm-hmm. I was trying to imagine... What if, like, Norman Lloyd died a few weeks ago?
Yeah.
What if I was at the local restaurant and I suddenly saw him in the corner with a fake mustache macking down on some tacos? What would I do? I'd wait and see.
Yeah, you want to be a part of that.
Do you think he'd be able to get away with that, by the way? No, I'm another 106-year-old man with a mustache.
Norman Lloyd doesn't have a mustache, so.
So your answer is yes.
Yeah. Now he leaves and goes back to work on his newest piece called Dancing Group when he hears this crazy buzzing sound. At first he thinks it's in his head, but then he realizes it's not. It seems to be coming from the hall, and he opens up the door and he sees Paul Kennicott sneaking up the stairs with this huge shiny black box. It's about 2 foot square, and he's trying to hide it in his coat, but it's way too big so he can see it, and the buzzing noise is coming from within this box.
A missing aviator who's slumming it with a crazy humming black box. There are all manner of people I would punch to get to the end of the story. That is such an exciting premise. Let's keep going.
Yes. The narrator calls him out and says, hey, I know who you are. What is going on, and what is that buzzing noise? So the landlady steps out and yells about the buzzing, thinking it's a radio and that radio is plugged in and it's going to be costing her money for the electricity. So Kennicott, he tells the narrator to stall the landlady and he runs up to his room. Once Kennicott goes into his room, the noise stops and the narrator tells the landlady it was his radio and he shut it off and he won't use it again. And this seems to placate her.
This is a little like that scene in Finally Fahrenheit where that character Dallas was like, I know who you are with your murdering android. You don't know what the ask is going to be yet, but the artist has already said, you tell me what's going on or I'll sell you out. Mm-hmm. And so you're wondering, is that all he's going to ask for? This is going to get interesting. Now we're entering crime pulpy world of that kind of thing. Blackmail.
After she's gone, the narrator goes to Kennicott's door. Kennicott lets him in and he can hear that buzzing noise. And I think by buzzing, they mean static. It says exactly like a radio tuned to a station that is temporarily off the air.
Yeah, you engaged a part of my brain that I was like, this is unnecessary for the story. But then I started wondering, well, when did static become a sound? Because I kind of imagined that it would be more like those humming noises you get from an old vacuum tube radio, which do sound like a hum. Instead of static on old radios when there's no signal. Okay. So yeah, the audiophile part of me went, I have to investigate the origin of static. And that is not something I need to be doing. So anyway, it's an electronics hum.
Sure. Our narrator, he wants to know what's going on. And now Kennicott is going to lay it all down.
Right. And another curtain rises. Another fantastic first scene. Our plane was demolished. We made a forced landing in the center of a dense jungle. If you know Brazil at all, you'll know what it was like. Trees, trees, trees. Crawling insects as big as your fist. A hot, sickening smell of rotting vegetation. And now and then the screech of some animal or bird. Eerie enough to make your hair stand on end. We cracked up right in the middle of nowhere. Bam! Just think of the sense of motion so far. We're not too distant into the story, but... You know, we didn't start the story with a guy writing his journal from his studio at the, you know, he's on a ship blasting through the ocean. And there's no reason to have it that way other than to give us that sense of motion. And then the story drops you in this urban squalor, then picks you up and crashes you in the jungle. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying this is one of the best things that we've read. You can feel that sense of motion that is missing in so much weird fiction that's epistolary and based on these journals. It really gets killed by the feeling that I had to wait 2 weeks between these responses and stuff. This thing is moving like a panther with yellow eyes.
Yeah, it is. He and his co-pilot, a fat little bald guy called McCrea, crawled out of the wreckage. It says, the fat little guy, bald, scared of women, and always cracking wise about something. A swell sport.
That scared of women? None of this plays into it because this guy's out of the picture right away, but I felt like it was some shorthand comedy relief. 1937, I don't think Abbott and Costello were a thing yet, but this specific comedy relief archetype was really popular. That archetype is really interesting to me because in this one sentence description, it says he's scared of women, always cracking jokes. And the thing I always liked about Costello or even Curly was that they're both the buffoon and the lovelorn. In a broader mass market story, the love story is going to be with the hot leads, you know, the nobles, the rich people. But when it's just a comedy, the clown has to be the one to get the girl. And I guess the reason I like that so much is that it rides the line between making fun of somebody for being fat and bald or whatever. But then Costello does get the girl, or at least he gets a date. Absolutely not the arc of McCrea in this story. So
no.
A little bit of a side path there.
No, the pilot was fine. But McCrea broke his leg and had a few broken ribs. The narrator asks if McCrea is dead, and Kennicott says, God only knows. I guess you call it death.
Go on.
They make their way through the jungle with some supplies for 2 days when they set up a camp because McCrea was running a fever. Kennicott went off to find some water. He came back and McCrea was gone. He tracked him through the jungle. A few hundred yards away south of camp, Kennicott hears this buzzing noise. It leads him to this part of the jungle where everything is black. Not burned, just turned to black. And not only that, it's hard and unbreakable.
Yeah, and those things are revealed in order in a nice way. I have some black succulents out on the balcony where I was actually reading this. So I looked up and thought, oh, okay, yeah, just like that. And then he compared them to a jungle of wrought iron. And I thought, oh, not like that. This is metal as f***. You know, how horrible, a wrought iron jungle? Whoa, this story just keeps delivering.
So the narrator suggests, oh, it was a petrified forest, but it's not. The leaves are black, like sculptures, and they're, like you said, they're unbreakable.
A conclusion that he's coming to, they're not breakable by him. I did find it kind of funny if it was just, he was just weak. They're actually quite breakable.
As he was looking around, he found McCrea's canteen and thought, okay, I'm on the trail. That noise was getting stronger and that it freaked him out, and he ran and started sobbing.
He says, I don't know why. Maybe it was the grinding monotony of the humming sound and the unrelieved black of that stone forest. And I'm thinking, or the plane crash or the missing friend. I'm not going to judge you for crying. It's okay.
These leaves on these black trees, they cut him as he runs through the jungle, and he finds himself back where he started. He's lost. He called out for McCrea, but no answer. He looks around and sees a black sculpture of a butterfly, perfectly detailed. And then he sees what he thinks is a stump, but it's not a stump. It was a black stone statue of McCrea, perfect in every detail. He pushes the statue over and picks it up. It's super light. It's like 20 pounds. And he tries to cut it, but it breaks his tool. No mark on the statue either, like nothing. And he thinks that this is some kind of weird joke or something. It just doesn't make any sense to him. So he keeps calling out for McCrea. And then he sees something crawl out from under a black bush.
I can't describe it. No one could. It resembled nothing so much as a star-shaped blob of transparent jelly that shimmered and changed colors like an opal. It appeared to be some lower form of animal, one-celled, not large, only about a foot in circumference when it stretched those feelers out to full length. It oozed along over the sand like a snail, groping its way with those star points. And it hummed. The droning noise ringing in my ears issued from this nightmare creature. It was nauseating to watch, and yet beautiful, too, with all these iridescent colors gleaming against that setting of dead black stone.
There's the monster.
Yeah.
Got a monster in here, too, and it's such a neat monster because the ones that really can kill you often don't have claws and teeth and are big. They're microbes. They're things like this. It just has an odd property.
So he nudges it with his foot. Then he puts his flying helmet on the ground in front of it, and it reaches out with one of its little pseudopods, and it turns the helmet to black stone. And not just the helmet, but the goggles on the helmet.
Well, although he didn't nudge it with his foot, he almost did. It says, I approached within a pace of it. Started to nudge it with my foot, but couldn't quite bring myself to touch the squashy thing.
Ah, there we go.
And he says, and I've thanked my stars ever since for being so squeamish. I just thought that detail is interesting because curiosity is what killed the last guy. This bit about the foot is just so you can get the, like you just laid out the rules. It got the helmet and the goggles, right? If you touch it, it does this. But the author is presenting these discoveries through some levels of internal struggle. It's so scary in a way to think that the character's lack of bravery is what saved his life. He's squeamish and that's why he's alive.
He realizes at that moment that Macrea is that stone statue. Nausea overcame me. I wanted to run to escape the sight of the oozing horror, but reason came to my rescue. I reminded myself that I am Paul Kennicott, intrepid explorer. Through a horrible experience, Macrea and I have stumbled upon something in the Brazilian wilds which would revolutionize the civilized world. He's got dollar signs in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
This thing could be used to make indestructible bridges, houses, buildings, roads, and made of something cheap that could be turned into this hard black stone.
This is, although, man, don't you see that chain reaction happening now? It's going to be Black Planet in 2 minutes. We're unveiling the big black bridge, and I'm not going to have any scientist warning us it could petrify the whole planet. It's Black Bridge Fest this summer. No, but this is actually narratively a good bridge to what happens later. I'm sure most readers would have figured out by this point what's the artist is going to do.
Yeah.
Kennicott is thinking about getting rich, but concurrently about how this could benefit civilization as a whole.
Yeah.
So it's a little more nuanced versus what happens later. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. He decides he's going to try and capture it. He does a bit of experimenting and discovers that whatever it touches and whatever that thing is touching turns it to this black stone. But the third thing, which is touching it, doesn't. So it's got a bit of a chain there. And once something is black stone, it is immune to the transfer effect. So, for example, you got a monkey and it's holding a gun with a New York Yankees hat on. If the creature touches the gun, then the monkey and the gun turn to stone, but the hat wouldn't. However, if the thing touched the monkey, the hat, the monkey, and the gun all turn to stone.
That was a great way to explain it. I wouldn't go near it at all. And neither would Norman Lloyd, by the way. The reason he's hiding out eating tacos with a mustache, it has nothing to do with the prophet scheme. He's got noble intentions.
You're kind of talking like this actually happened.
You know what? Let's cut that. Forget it. Move on. That was a crazy for example I was given earlier.
Okay. So it took Kennicott 3 days to trap this thing in a little black box that he made out of fabric and wood, which he, of course, turned to stone. He had to spend all of his money to get out of Brazil. The natives didn't want to go anywhere near him because of the buzzing sound. And, of course, Kennicott's very paranoid. He's afraid someone's going to try and take it from him, rob him of his discovery. And he says to the narrator, "Do you realize what's in that box?" He grinned with boyish delight. "Fame and fortune. That's what. Macrea's family will never know want again. Science will remember our names along with Edison and Bell and all the rest. We've discovered a new force that will rock the world with its possibilities." So at this point, the narrator is thinking as a sculptor. He's read The Mask from The King in Yellow. He's got dollar signs in his own eyes.
Of course, yeah. We've got people turn into stone all over the place in the episode library. There's a formula bath that turns into marble in one of them, I remember.
Yeah, well, that's The Mask.
Is that The Mask? Yeah. Okay, then all the way back to Lovecraft's collaboration with Hazel Heald, The Man of Stone, which I think we didn't mention when we were on that episode, but that was a formula that turns people to stone.
Yeah.
This is my favorite treatment of it so far, even though we've done quite a few of these.
Now, Kennicott asks him to keep quiet. He says, "You're some kind of artist, right? I can set you up with a studio of your dreams." The narrator thinks, "Some kind of artist? Perhaps if he had not said that. Flaying my crushed pride and ambition to the quick, I would never have done the awful thing I did."
That is so real, man. So real. If I'm honest with myself, I think a lot of larger things I've done in my life, there's some snub way down there in the core of it.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever, you must have remembered that when you're working like some job you hated and they'd go, "Oh, you like to draw," or something patronizing.
Yeah.
You go, "There is no reason for this person not to treat me this way, but I am filled with rage that you would dare talk to an artist of my talent." I even think, I was thinking about it, I'm probably doing this show now because I'm dyslexic and my language skills were so turned around when I was little. My teachers were like, this kid isn't going to function normally. Oh, yeah? You're right, I don't function normally, but my language skills are going to be really, really good. Defeated.
He says to Kennicott, your story is insane. Why would I believe such a crazy story? There is nothing in that box.
You manipulated him there. Really nice. Maybe if you showed me and we got kind of close to it, I'd understand what you're talking about. I mean, I don't know how he doesn't see this coming, given that he's gotten this thing all the way out of Brazil. But
yeah, Kennicott says, well, of course you need some proof. So Kennicott opens the box and he puts a book inside and the book turns to black stone. And he remembers the rule about the third thing in the chain, grabbed Kennicott's arm and thrust it into the box. The sleeve hardened beneath my fingers.
You know, because I thought I saw the ending coming and what the irony was going to be there, I thought that in this moment we might get some violent misdirection. Instead of using the device, he just whacks him over the skull or something. All I really thought for some reason that that was going to happen. Yeah. But nope, he used the stone. It's the logical thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, he pulls out the statue of Kennicott and closes the box. Mrs. Bates, that's the landlady, is coming up the stairs because she could hear this buzzing sound, and he explains to her it's a battery radio, not using any of her electricity, and that the lodger, that was his model, the guy that she was talking with before, of his new piece. And here it is. I finished my new piece. See? Yeah. It looks just like the guy. Oh, and wow. Since he's finished, he's going to not be around anymore, so don't worry about it. And you can keep that money for the room that we had. So
yeah.
She seems to be happy with this, and she leaves the narrator to take his newest piece to the Museum of Fine Arts. Ironically, I chose to call it Fear of the Unknown. Why is that ironic?
I was kind of wondering that myself. Because is it, yeah, who was afraid of the unknown? Is it because we know exactly what happened? Is that why it's ironic?
Is that? We know what happened, but it's still an unknown thing. This blob is a creature, and that it's definitely something to be afraid of.
I think that like any artist who's not really that great, he throws irony around as a means to sound intelligent and doesn't really know what it means.
He explains all of his works were just models he tricked into posing, and then he touched with the creature.
That's such an extra level of dirtbaggery to turn this into like a body snatchers thing, because he could have been the best sculptor at butterflies and fragile things. I mean, there would have been a way around to use this to become famous. He didn't have to get people involved. Oh.
But in this letter, he admits he's a fraud. He had no real talent. Maybe if he actually worked at it, he could have achieved talent, but he chose the easy, evil way. And now he can no longer bear it, and he's going to become his last sculpture.
Once again, we see that the final thing comes last.
He explains that he's on the boat and he's going to open the box over the water so that when it touches him, the creature will fall into the sea. And I guess water doesn't turn to stone then, huh?
It does when you try and fight it, like I have in the past.
I wonder if the process of being turned into that black rock is painful, or if it is accompanied only by a feeling of lethargy. And McCrae, Paul Kennicott, and those unfortunate models whom I have passed off as my work, are they dead as we know death, or are their statues sentient and possessed of nerves? How does that chilly creature feel to the touch? Does it impart a violent electrical shock or a subtle emanation of some force beyond our ken, changing the atom structure of the flesh it turns to stone? Many such questions have occurred to me often in the small hours when I lie awake, tortured by remorse for what I have done. But tonight, gentlemen, I shall know all the answers.
That's the end of the story.
Such a great, even if you see it coming, I mean, it has to end that way with him being his own sculpture.
Hmm.
I loved the story. I mean, I just really did. It was, if that's not obvious.
Yeah, it's a great story. It was super fun and easy to read. It was just one of those where you start and then it's over. You're like, what happened? Did I just read a story? I guess I did.
Yeah, it had a feeling of, you know, sometimes I try to recapture. There were so many anthology shows on when we were kids. And sometimes it'd be like a Sunday night or after dinner and you'd sit down and watch a Twilight Zone. And it was just really satisfying. And I can never recapture that now. I'll sit down and try and watch these anthology shows. And, you know, they're fine. Obviously, it was because I was a kid and just didn't know that This was all new to me. Mm-hmm. But you know what? This one got me that way. Wasn't expecting it. Sat down and just had a really nice pocket-sized little tale spooled out. And it's very similar to a lot of other things we've read. And I still really enjoyed it. So
yeah, it's really great.
Glad to have gotten this author on the show.
Yeah. She's really great. And we're definitely going to cover her other story, The Three Marked Pennies, eventually. But next month, we're going to be doing something a little different, a kind of a genre of writing we haven't covered specifically because it is that. But stories about people making monsters.
Yeah, we've definitely covered some monster-making stories.
Yes.
And I think there's even an Edgar Rice Burroughs maybe called The Monster Maker. And then I think there is also a Ray Bradbury. Somebody goes, The Monster Maker by Ray Bradbury, perhaps? So we got a lot of great suggestions. So that's going to be fun to comb through. I'm not sure exactly what the selections are yet. But when we get them, they're going to go up. It's going to be a fun summer month of monsters. And I want to thank our reader once again.
Mike Hughes is a wonderful human being.
Let's thank some patrons.
I love thanking patrons. Chuck Trudeau, Truax. Thank you.
I love that you did that. He put Truax in parentheses, I think, to let you know.
Truax.
That's how to pronounce his name. But you still said Chuck Tro, and as if Truax was his nickname. And that's because you read these Fofford and Gray Mouse stories all the time. So, of course, you're going to assume that he goes, call me Truax, for my axe always fells my enemy truly. I also want to thank Juan Sandoval.
I'd like to thank Ricky Bella.
I want to thank Shuddle, S-H-U-D-D-L.
Thank you, Chris Petch.
Thank you, Paxton Clewer.
I'd like to thank Ben Douglas.
Thank you, Matt Hildebrand.
Thank you, Michael Grubb.
And finally, Craig Rueth. Thank you so much. Folks, we'll be back with some monsters. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Here at HPPodcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.